Welcome to In Gad We Trust, a podcast based in and around classic era golden age detective fiction of the 1920s to the 1940s. My name is Jim, I blog at The Invisible Event, and the plan for this podcast is that each episode features me in conversation with fellow bloggers, with authors, with enthusiasts in the genre, to talk about a topic of their choosing. So today, for this second episode, I am joined by Aidan, who blogs at Mysteries Ahoy. Hi, Aidan.
Hi, Jim. How are you doing?
Yeah, I'm not all bad, thanks. Thank you very much for coming on my crazy new podcast.
You're welcome.
And so today, Aidan and I are going to talk about the inverted mystery. Now, would you be able to explain to listeners, since you selected the topic, what we mean when we talk about an inverted mystery?
Yeah, I think there are a couple of different definitions we could go with. R. Austin Freeman is generally credited as being the creator of the traditional inverted mystery. And he wrote a collection of short stories called The Singing Bone. And in those stories, the reader already has knowledge of who the killer is. You actually witness the crime being committed right from the point at which they're first considering doing it. You learn their motive, you learn what they did, and then halfway through the story, he resets, and you then follow a different character, the detective, as he tries to work out from the evidence left at the crime scene what happened. So his style of story is very forensics-driven. We would call it a how catch'em, because you are really focused on the question of how will the detective figure out the identity of the killer. There are other types of inverted mysteries, though, which are much broader, which can encompass any type of question other than the question of who committed the crime. So you could ask why they did it. You can ask how they did it. You could even ask who the victim is. So there are all kinds of different questions you can use. And I tend to think of it as being like a mathematical equation, where traditionally you're looking for A plus B equals C, but you could rework that formula so that you're looking for A or B. And for me, it's that diversity of the inverted mystery that really makes it interesting.
Yeah, that's. I think that covers the broad range quite well, because I think when we talk about the inverted mystery, there are famous examples that we can cite. Probably the most famous is Malice Aforethought by Francis Iles, the pen name of Anthony Berkeley. Mm-hmm. There is Heir Presumptive by Henry Wade. Freeman wrote a couple of full-length novels that are inverted mysteries. To date, I've only read Mr. Potomac's Oversight, but that's a similar thing where what you see is Mr. Potomac committing a murder, you learn his reasons for committing that murder, and then Dr. John Thorndike comes in and starts to unpick it piece by piece. And in that one, you have the two threads running parallel, where you see Potomac do something and Thorndike unpick it, and Potomac do something and then Thorndike come in at the end to unpick it again. But I think you're right. I think there is a tremendous diversity possible.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that one of the things that is particularly interesting is seeing how this style changed and where it came from. So from my perspective, I think we sometimes get it wrong by saying that the inverted mystery is the inversion. To me, what is becoming increasingly apparent is that before the detective novel, most people read crime stories following that perspective of the killer. They were interested in why a crime was committed and what led them to do it. So you get things like in the Regency period and the early Victorian age, when you went to a public hanging, which people did for fun back then, you would purchase a broadside newspaper for a penny, and it would have a description of what the killer did, how they did it, why they did it, and some sort of little statement about how very sorry they were. Some of it was genuine interviews with the murderer themselves. Sometimes they just faked it. People have always been interested in crime stories, and I think that the detective story flipped things around and asked the question as to how does the detective figure out from a vast number of suspects with a small amount of information who the killer is. The inverted mystery sort of flips it back and re-engages the reader with the question as to what was really driving the murderer to do the act in the first place. So it tends to be much more psychological, which I think is why you don't get this approach until the 1910s.
See, I've always felt that where you had your novels out of which the Golden Age was born, your sort of extended Gothic suspense, they almost seem to me to be the more natural antecedents of the inverted mystery than anything approaching a novel of psychological suspense, because you have some gloomy, mysterious house with a gloomy, mysterious man occupying it almost to the exclusion of everybody else. He might have a couple of suspicious servants. He's usually unmarried. It's usually very, very, very obvious that he's up to no good. And when the Golden Age came about, what the likes of Gaston Leroux with The Mystery of the Yellow Room, what latterly Agatha Christie and Freeman Wills Crofts and authors in the 1920s started to do, was they took that idea and instead of making the villain quite so obvious, they popularized what I in the past have called the democratization of suspicion, where suddenly it wasn't so obvious who the killer was. As you say, that's what the traditional detective novel was. But to me, the inverted mystery seems like a far more logical extension of that Gothic novel of, I suppose, suspense, for want of another word, because it's obvious from the start who the bad guy is, and yet they would still, at the end, you'd be like, oh my God, you mean the evil glowering man with all of the power and all of the influence is using his power and influence to in some way discredit the poor serf servant who has a beautiful fiancé that the evil glowering man wishes to marry? Who'd have thought it? And it just seems like a far more, or it seemed to me, like a far more honest use of that setup to go, well, okay, we know this guy's going to turn out to be the bad guy. So let's start page one. They're the bad guy. And let's just kind of build everything from there.
Yeah, I think that what you're talking about really is that detective fiction is a sort of game that the reader plays. And with the inverted story, there is a game element sometimes. So a typical idea is that you will have the killer commits a crime and they cover it up. And they read a lot of detective fiction, so they know all of the things that usually get killers in trouble. So they try and cover everything up, but they leave one or two loose ends, or in the way they cover the first thing up, they make something else more obvious. So the reader will spot those things and go, ah, I know what that is. That's going to be important later on. And the reader feels like they've done something very clever. I think in the traditional detective story, when you have a clue that stands out, I think the reader gets agitated or frustrated that they've spotted something that the writer didn't do a good enough job of hiding. So in some ways, I think the inverted story is structurally easier for a writer to tell because there is that sense of, I know who the killer is. It's okay for me to know that. In fact, it's the point for me to know that. I'm going to be more interested in finding out how that cat and mouse game affects the killer, what mistakes they make when the pressure is applied to them. And it incorporates that element of suspense that you were talking about. So you know what's coming. We know he's going to get caught at the end. We're pretty well sure what kinds of things might lead to him getting caught. We want to see what actually happens.
The flip side of that is, though, in much the same way as you quite correctly say, readers feel hard done by when they spot a clue that they don't feel the writer has done a good enough job of occluding in typical detective fiction. Detective fiction being a game between the reader and the writer, obviously what the form started to do then was it started to throw in these very deliberate red herring clues where they would want you to spot something obvious and to fixate on that, but for that to actually not be as relevant as it appears.
Yeah.
And it's fair to say, isn't it, that then the same thing started to happen with the inverted mystery, because the expectation, like you quite rightly say, is we start off, we have somebody who we know is going to commit a crime, we witness the commission of the crime, and then the expectation is that we see the criminal be brought to justice for that crime. But then the inverted mystery started to play around with that, because obviously we won't get into specific titles, but we know that there are inverted mysteries where, for instance, our criminal doesn't actually commit the crime, or our killer isn't actually the killer.
Yeah.
Or where when they face justice, what they face justice for is not actually the crime that we have seen them commit.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a great point. And On my blog, I've divided Inverted Mysteries into a number of different subcategories. The one I can never talk about is this exact one, what I call a false inverted. Because if you know that the false inverted is there, it spoils the entire reading experience for you. So yeah, there is certainly a type of book where the reader is caught by surprise by what the end point of the story will be.
Yeah.
But even if it's not an inverted mystery in the sense that they're not the killer, you still have the same set of psychological thoughts and feelings being explored. So it does still feel like an inverted story.
So in that way, the inverted mystery and the traditional detective story actually have a lot more in common than it might initially seem, don't they? Because they are both trying to show you a certain amount of information and be supposedly fair and open about the declaration of information, while also both trying to hold something back in the hope that they are going to surprise you in the final instance.
Yeah, there are certainly a number of inverted stories that do that. As you say, there are those false inverted stories, but there are other ones where the reader has a lot of the information, but they don't necessarily have it from the perspective of an outsider. So one thing that the inverted story does very well is it knows what the perspective of one character is and what the perspective of another one is, and it can play those two things off against each other. So you get some writers like Freeman's Wills Crofts who do this very well. They will tell the story from the perspective of the killer, and then partway through they'll shift to the perspective of the detective. But they don't throw away the killer at that point. They keep both characters in sight, and they're aware of each other. So what you'll then get is this kind of elevated cat and mouse game, which is impossible in a traditional detective story because you're not supposed to know who the killer is. But in an inverted story, you do. So the killer can do additional things, knowing what the detective is trying to do to try and throw them off their track. And the reader is in on the trick. And that can add a layer of complexity to it that, as I say, is just impossible in a detective story without spoiling the surprise.
Crofts is a really nice example to pick at you on the back of that conversation we've just been having, because he wrote a few inverted detective novels. The one I have read was the British Library reissue of Antidote to Venom, which is a great example of the game playing, because in a weird sort of way, he manages to play both the inverted game and the traditional game, because of course we know that two people cook up a scheme between them to kill a third person. So when that murder happens, we know who is responsible. What we don't know is how the murder was achieved. And so it is one of those rare instances where someone actually gets to both eat their cake and have it too, because we get that inverted game where you can see the action of certainly one of the guilty parties and the detective. But for a reader, there is also that element of disclosure still to come about how it was achieved in the first place, and so there is almost like a dual track of investigation running through the entire novel.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I think that if you look at Croft's works, and Antidote to Venom is a great example, you do have that sense of that game being played, and I think French is kind of the perfect detective to do this with, because he is a detective who is so focused on evidence and logic that you can try and manipulate him. I think it's an even better example of that is the 1230 from Croydon, which is played even more from the killer's point of view. And in that, French is like this figure who's in the background all the time. We very rarely actually get to see him directly, but the killer is always aware of what he's doing, and he thinks he's being really clever by doing things to manipulate him. And I think that's always entertaining. I mean, you look at a show like Columbo, which has had such a long life and continues to be popular, it plays the same game. The killer thinks that they can outsmart the detective, and we're along for the ride as they manipulate things, they set false trails, and inevitably they make mistakes. So I definitely think that cat and mouse game is a big part of the appeal for me as a reader. But I know that you've had a slightly different relationship to the inverted mystery than me. You certainly weren't always a fan. What are some of your experiences with them?
For me, I think my experience of the inverted mystery was very different because I came to it through much later examples of it. I've written quite extensively on my blog about how my entry to crime fiction in general was a lot of English and particularly American writers from the late 90s and the early 2000s. And at around that time, it feels to me, a lot of what was being written in the inverted form was just grotesquely, pornographically violent serial killer stories that are almost this very thinly veiled attempt to just try to be as violent on the page as possible. And you look at something like, I don't know, American Psycho, which people will claim is this satire about the excess of the 1980s. And yeah, maybe or it may not be, but it's not the kind of book that I enjoy reading, where it's just so, so, so violent and takes such pleasure in that perverted form of violence. And so for me, I think the issue I had with the inverted mystery in terms of enjoying it was that actually I hadn't encountered particularly good examples of it. They were not stories being written with this philosophy that you've talked about in mind, with this being able to enjoy the cat and mouse element between the detective and the criminal. They were just written because it's cheap titillation.
Yeah, I have had a very similar experience to you. I don't like stories that explore the guts and the gore of murder. That has never been my interest. What captures my imagination are stories that speak to our understanding about what it means to be human or what it means to find yourself in an impossible situation. Mm. I think that's one thing the inverted mystery does very well. It encourages you to have an empathy, not necessarily a feeling that you would do the same thing, but to understand what leads some people to do terrible things. In the very earliest stories, you have an awful lot of blackmailers who are then offed, because that's very easy, right? A blackmailer is a despicable human being. Your victim is usually someone who's made one mistake and who will compound it by making additional ones. But you do get that kind of change that happens in the inverted story. And I think you can kind of place it to a period. It's really post-war, post-World War II, you get this real shift in what an inverted story looks like. And it becomes much more focused on the idea of, we're going to watch someone unpleasant do something unpleasant, and they will get called to account, probably. In almost every case they do. But there is much more of a focus on the act of violence. There is much more of an exploration of the very human instincts that lead them to that, and it increasingly borders on titillation rather than any kind of a meaningful exploration of theme or character. For me, there are some great examples of ones which do it artfully, but then it, as you say, it really, by the 1970s, it becomes much more focused on, I'm going to show you someone doing these absolutely despicable things. Do you think it's important to you that you have sympathy with a killer in inverted mystery? What's your take on that?
I think that's a very good question. I know that something like Mr. Potomac's Oversight by Austin Freeman was a real revelation for me for the way in which it makes Marcus Potomac into this incredibly sympathetic murderer. And it's the 1930s, so there's this huge amount of financial uncertainty behind everything anyway. So like you say, typically what you start off with is there are a lot of blackmailers. And so not only is there the moral element of it that I think everybody finds reprehensible in these future victims, but there's also this idea of them exploiting these incredibly straitened financial times, which fits beautifully with the era in which these things are set and written. Mm-hmm. At the same time, you get something like Malice Aforethought by Francis Isles, which you mentioned earlier, where the first sentence says pretty much, it was one Tuesday afternoon when Dr. Bickley knew that he was going to have to murder his wife. And his reasons for murdering his wife are not necessarily all that sympathetic, in the sense that you empathize and wish for his success. I mean, he wants to murder his wife because she is effectively a social harridan who's trying to push him into a social situation that he's not necessarily very happy with. And he has, frankly, been putting it about every single eligible woman in the district anyway. And he just likes the idea of having a younger and more attractive woman on his arm.
Yeah.
But there's something about him that is not sympathetic, but you do have a strange sort of empathy for his situation. I would argue that with both him and with Mr. Potomac, there is that tremendous understanding of where they're coming from. With Potomac, I would argue that you want him to get away with it. I would argue that you look at the situation in which he is in, and, you know, Marcus Potomac is not an innocent at all. I mean, if anything, to a certain extent, if you put the infidelity to one side, Bickley in Malice Aforethought is a much more innocent character. And Potomac is not an innocent in the least. But I have far more desire to see Potomac, or far more hope that Potomac is going to get away with it, than I do have hope that Bickley is going to get away with it.
Absolutely. I think that Malice Aforethought is such an important book in the development of the inverted mystery, because it establishes this male type that you see constantly referred to in later books, certainly throughout the 1930s, this kind of buffoon. You have this character who is going to do horrible things, and they are incompetent. They are not capable of committing a good murder. So I think the best example is Richard Hull and the murder of my aunt. That character mm-hmm. is a bumbling idiot that you kind of assume would be played by a Christopher Biggins type person if it was filmed in the 1970s. He just wants to play with his little poodle and read erotic French novels. And his aunt won't let him do it. So he's going to try and murder her, and he has no ability. Obviously, in the case of Malice Aforethought, he at least has medical knowledge. But even there, you have this idea that he is unpleasant, but we don't entirely think he will be able to do the task. And I think that gives us permission to laugh. Books like Malice Aforethought, books like Murder of My Aunt, very early on tell you in comical sequences it's okay to laugh at this book, and that instantly allows you to have a sense that we're not going to be engaging emotionally with a character who is going to end up being someone who's triumphant, and that we're going to have to feel horribly ashamed of ourselves for liking at the end of the book.
At the same time, there isn't that desire to get you to feel we're going to show you the dark underbelly, the real side of criminality that it very much morphed into in those late 90s, early 2000s books that I was reading.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that the author who probably does the best job of hitting that balance between making really unpleasant characters and situations where you feel okay liking them would be someone like Jim Thompson.
Mm-hmm.
Jim Thompson's characters are despicable. Mm. They're horrible. They're sociopaths. Yep. They do things that you would never want to meet any one of those characters, really. I can't think of a single. You might know them. You might know people like them, but you definitely don't want to meet them. In a Jim Thompson novel, you know that people are going to make flawed decisions, and they're going to be hoisted by themselves in some way later on.
Yeah.
That ultimately it's okay to like them a little bit, because you know that they will be held to account. Not always for the thing that they thought they were doing, which is one of my favorite aspects of his writing, that people tend to get caught out by something that was never even a consideration for them. Mm. Yeah, you're given this permission to like them a little bit, enough to empathize with them, enough to feel interested in what's going to happen to them.
I think from a certain perspective inside of classic mystery fandom, there is the argument that Thompson doesn't really fit in. But at the same time, he has written reams of truly fantastic, effectively inverted mysteries, where, as you say, you have to live through the steady capitulation of the schemes of these just horrible, sad, broken down losers that you would never call the main characters of Jim Thompson's novels heroes. They are at best protagonists, but you certainly wouldn't call them heroes. And you get something like Nothing More Than Murder, where not dissimilar to Bickley and Malice Aforethought, is motivated by sex, and you get these two young people who are effectively trying to commit this crime. They put all these plans together, they sit, they talk about it, they convince themselves that they're brilliant and they're going to get away with it. And the first time that we're introduced to them, it's already going wrong. And there is a lovely commentary on that. You're absolutely right. There is definitely something really walking a line between looking at the horror of it, but also looking at sort of the hopelessness of the people involved. There is a Thompson book, and I won't name it, but it is effectively one of his inverted mysteries. There is a Jim Thompson book where I think he fell in love with his main character a little bit, because effectively at the end, he does get away with it.
Yeah.
And at the time, I was just like, that's very odd. Like, you know, normally you do get this sense of closure around something, usually with some satirical, you know, Anthony Barclay-esque sting to it. But one of his books, the central character in which is an absolute joy to spend time with, they do effectively completely get away with everything they've done. And I think it's because Thompson himself just liked that character so much and couldn't bring himself to punish them.
Yeah. I can see that. I think that a lot of his characters have this enormous life to them in a way that very few crime writers are able to achieve. You get the sense they could live on past the story that they're in. Because he often incorporates more than one character that we might think of as a protagonist, that does allow sometimes for one of them to be successful and for another one to be caught or to be caught up in some way that feels like an apt punishment for that character. The idea of justice not always being evenly applied is certainly present in a lot of his work. He feels more modern than Golden Age, and I understand why some people don't like him. What interests me is that he manages to suggest the unpleasantness often without actually showing you it. You very rarely get moments of hyper-violence described in detail. And I think his unfortunate legacy is that a number of writers who came after him, who were inspired by him, chose to show you everything that he left out. And that's where my interest kind of stops.
Mm.
But I think that a good question to ask is, why did that happen? Why did we get away from the genteel guy who wants to off his aunt or the person who's trying to inherit a family fortune? And why did we move towards these more bitter tales or caustic tales of hardened sociopaths doing what they're doing? And I think that the answer for me lies in the trauma that everyone went through in World War II.
Yeah.
You get it a little bit earlier in the American books, and I think that the reason for that is because of the enormous toll the Great Depression took. But Britain's a much more ordered society, so I think that until World War II happens, it's kind of difficult to have those stories told. And the minute everyone has gone off to war, everyone has been desensitized by that horrific experience, you then have a breakdown in society that enables you to tell those kinds of stories. At least that's my opinion. It's like, I call them kitchen sink inverteds. They are very much focused on those motivations for people who've come back from war and don't want to wait to be successful anymore. And they almost feel like cautionary tales to me about what might happen if we don't do something socially.
I think that's quite fair. And I think as well, if you look at the way in which the genre went on to develop from there, and again, I'm aware we're getting away from the Golden Age again, and I will drag everything back because there's a question I want to ask you about Golden Age in a minute. But I think if you look at the way things developed from there, say through the 50s, where you get that very individualized, jaundiced view of things where people have to suddenly make their own way, if you like, I think the same thing then starts to extend into the 1970s when you start to get a certain disenfranchised view of the political situation with Vietnam, with Watergate. And I arguably, and this is probably a conversation for another time, but arguably at that point, what you then start to get is your inverted mystery, where the main character is a killer who does bad things for a bad reason, then starts to turn into your anti-hero, where your main character is a probably semi-bad person who does bad things, but for a good reason. And then the genre develops in this kind of, you end up with your John D. McDonald, Travis McGee, and all that kind of later hoo-ha.
Or Dexter. I mean, a serial killer who catches other serial killers. So I think you're exactly right. I think that the more society breaks down, the more your protagonist changes to become less and less likable, and they just become the least bad option in this group of absolutely atrocious human beings.
Okay, so let's properly get back to the Golden Age now, because this is fundamentally where the majority of our blogging and certainly the majority of our interest lies. If you had to pick, say, two or three inverted mysteries to recommend to people who wanted to try them, which ones would you pick and why?
The obvious one you have to begin with is Malice Aforethought. It is the most influential of all of them. So I would certainly say you want to read that. I'm not the biggest fan of Malice Aforethought, I will say. I like it. I think it's very good. But I think it's that thing of when a book gets recommended to you so much, by the time you actually sit down to read it, you have built it up so much in your head that it can never quite match what you expect.
Yeah.
And it's a little bit slow in the second half. The first half is amazing.
Yes.
And it's really funny and it's clever and it is horrific. I mean, you talk about how Dr. Bickley is kind of someone that we have permission to laugh at, but what he does to his wife is horrendous. And it is truly repulsive. So I certainly would suggest that. I would say that because it's available, The 1230 from Croydon by Freeman Wills Croft is a very good How Catch Him story, told mostly from the perspective of the killer. Antidote to Venom is really good as well, but it has this moral discussion to it that I think can come off a little heavy-handed. If I was to pick between those two, I would say Croydon is a easier first read.
Okay.
I have to recommend Family Matters by Anthony Rowles. I think that book is amazing. It was actually my first inverted mystery.
Mm.
And it's the book that made me want to blog. And yet I've never actually really written about it on my blog.
That's incredible.
For people who have never read the story, it basically sets up a situation where there's this man that two different people are trying to kill for different reasons. And I'm laughing even just thinking about it.
One
of them is his wife. One of them is the local doctor. And unfortunately, they're each unaware of the other person's actions. It is very funny. Yeah. And everyone I've recommended it to has kind of raised an eyebrow when I've told them. And then they've come back to me and said they really enjoyed it. It manages to be very funny. It hits the points you want in an inverted story, which you do want to see bad people brought to justice in some way. And I think it's a danger with the comedic type of inverted stories. They kind of dry out towards the end.
Mm.
They run their course and the last 50 or 60 pages becomes much less funny than everything that came before.
Yeah.
With Family Matters, basically the punchline comes at the end. So you can keep reading and you know you've got good stuff still ahead of you. I like The Murder of My Aunt, but I certainly wouldn't recommend the second half of that book. Which, you know, when I read that book, I was in hysterics. I don't normally laugh out loud when I read. There is an extended passage at the beginning of The Murder of My Aunt involving a car that I think is one of the funniest chapters of a book I've ever read. And I certainly would suggest, if you're into inverted mysteries, go ahead and read it. But it perhaps isn't your best first one. Two more I'll recommend very quickly. Heir Presumptive by Henry Wade. Yes. So what do you think is great about that book?
Just everything. I mean, it is a magnificent achievement. I am so full of admiration for that book. I read a couple of Henry Wade books prior to it and quite liked them. And then I read that one and I was just like, oh my God, this guy is astonishing. It's very, very, very clever. It's very funny. it does something which I think is incredibly rare in Golden Age detective fiction, in that there is a sequence where our principal criminal, for want of a better word, kills someone while off on a hunting trip. And there is this astonishing, and I honestly, I've got the hairs on my arms are standing up as I'm starting to talk about this. It is this incredible, protracted scene in which he kills someone for whatever reason. It doesn't really matter for the purpose of discussing it. And you are talked through the victim dying in a way that is just so electrifying. And it's something which was really not dwelt upon in fiction at the time. You know, you get something like Hercule Poirot's Christmas by Agatha Christie, where you have this scene of carnage with all of this blood all over the room, but it's discovered after the fact. You hear the furniture thudding around as two people fight, and everything, there's a scream, everything goes quiet, you break the door down, and then there is the dead body with all of the blood around it. What Heir Presumptive does is it just makes you sit and very calmly just watch while somebody bleeds to death in front of you. And it's not the only thing to recommend the book, far, far from it, but like that is... That for me was the point at which that book became just a masterpiece. I mean, everything from that point, everything to that point, and everything from that point on is magisterially handled. And the ending of the book and the way in which comeuppance comes about is so neatly and so smartly handled. But the thing that really excels it is Wade's fearlessness in talking through this central death for me.
Yeah, I think that's such a striking moment. It is so violent, and yet it's not like it's described in very visceral terms. It's that you get the sense as to what that moment means to the killer and what it feels like to take a life.
Yes.
And suddenly something that's kind of conceptual becomes very real. I think that that is an astonishing sequence. And, you know, Henry Wade is a writer who can often feel like his books are quite long. That book is a book that is probably one of his longest ones, and yet it reads so quickly because you get so invested in those characters and in this insane situation. I think if you're looking for a master of the inverted story from the Golden Age, I definitely think you need to look at Henry Wade. He wrote another one called Too Soon to Die, which is very good. I think it unfortunately, it collapses a little bit towards the end. And another one called Diplomat's Folly, which is right at the beginning of that kind of post-war, much more interested in the violent aspects. But his approach is not to revel in the violence. It's just, this is a deeply unpleasant human being committing a murder. And he manages to really create these three-dimensional feeling killers to me that you can understand why they're doing it. They're not someone you want to see succeed. And so you get a book like Released for Death, which is easily his most sympathetic situation. It's published before World War II, and it features a character who has been in prison, has been released, intends to go straight, and finds that everything is against him. And it explores these themes of recidivism and this idea that if nobody gives these ex-convicts a chance, this cycle is going to perpetuate itself. It is a really interesting book. It touches on some actual deep themes. It's much more than just an entertainment. It has a social point to it that is far more, that kind of breaks from the image that I think a lot of us have of Wade as this deeply conservative writer. He certainly has that in him, but he is someone who interested in the motivations, the explanation of why people kill. And I think he does it so well. The other book I really want to draw people's attention to, and it is unfortunately outside of the Golden Age, but it's just on the edge, so I hope you'll bear with me, is Ira Levine's A Kiss Before Dying, which is an early post-war book. It's an American novel, and it does something that I think is amazing. It is a hybrid type of story that combines inverted aspects, a traditional whodunit and a thriller. And it does that by breaking it into three distinct sections. So the first third of the book is told from the perspective of the killer, but you never get told their name. And then when that first third of the book ends, you then get put into the eyes of a different character who is then trying to work out who the killer was. And so you get to play the whodunit game after you've enjoyed or experienced. I wouldn't say enjoyed, actually, because they are a horrible, horrible killer. But you get to experience it through their eyes, and then you get to try and work backwards and unpick things and use the psychological clues you had to try and work out who the killer is. I guarantee you that almost everyone who reads it will be wrong. And then the final third is just this amazing race against time thriller. So if you've never read it, it is my favorite crime novel. I would certainly suggest that one. What about you, Jim? Which books would you suggest that people read that I haven't referenced so far?
There are a couple that spring to mind. The first is Case for Sergeant Beef by Leo Bruce, which takes you through the thought process of someone who wishes to commit a murder and get away with it. And so what they intend to do is murder someone they have no connection to and for whom there is no motive for them to kill. And it starts from that very simple premise. And it never really ends up hugely complicated, but certainly the way in which Bruce, who had this wonderfully satirical eye on the trappings of detective fiction at the time that he was writing, he just turns it into something very, very, very clever while also making it an inverted mystery. Bruce is a very up and down writer for me. His debut, Case for Three Detectives, is fantastic. His second book, Case Without a Corpse, is very clever, but since you know what has to happen at the end, you know that the series detective has to solve it.
Yes.
Unfortunately, 80% of the length of that book is just treading water while you wait for other people to be wrong so that Sergeant Beef can come in and solve it. And then something like Case with No Conclusion is just an absolutely fantastic book. And yeah, Case for Sergeant Beef is another one of those. The murderer is, in keeping with not quite being able to take these people terribly seriously because of their blundering, the murderer in that book has the magnificent name of Wellington Chickle, which just... I mean, Freeman Wells Crofts has some astonishing names of characters we're supposed to have sympathy with.
Runciman Jellicoe is one that stands out for me. But yeah.
Yeah, Crofts has some unfortunately hilarious names, but I'm pretty sure Bruce deliberately gave Wellington Chickle this ludicrous sobriquet because he is supposed to be this farcical wannabe murderer. Another book that I would also recommend, which isn't exclusively inverted mysteries, would be the collected short fiction of Stanley Ellen.
Yeah.
They were published under the title The Speciality of the House. So it's an anthology of all of his short crime fiction. And in much the same way that Family Matters was the book that made you excited about inverted mysteries and made you appreciate inverted mysteries, it was Ellen's short stories and that collection in particular that made me appreciate the short story. Because I think, like a lot of people getting into crime fiction and getting into short stories, I read the Sherlock Holmes stories.
Yes.
And the Sherlock Holmes stories are very much in that tradition that we were talking about earlier, just because of the era in which they're written, that sort of that late Gothic Victorian setup where you get something like, I think it's A Case of Identity that has four characters. You've got Dr. Watson, Sherlock Holmes, the beautiful young woman who comes to Sherlock Holmes because suspicious stuff is happening to her, and her gigantically suspicious uncle, who is in no way suspicious, who just happens to be a bit suspicious, but he's not suspicious, and there's no way he's going to turn out to be the criminal. And so many of the Holmes stories, while they hang together with some very good reasoning, there really was this lack of, again, what I call the democratization of suspicion. And then you get Stanley Ellen's short stories, which there are never, nothing is a sequel to anything else, so there are never any repeated characters. And the range of styles and approaches that that man adopted over the course of his career, and I've read quite a few of his novels, and I personally find his short stories to be much more successful. He's a bit like Clayton Rawson in that regard. I do think his short fiction is vastly superior to his novel length stuff. But what Ellen does is he writes some amazingly clever inverted mysteries and frames them in a way that almost makes them not inverted mysteries, but at the same time, you know exactly who the killer is and what the crime is and how they're responsible for it. And so a story like The Orderly World of Mr. Appleby, which is this guy who marries rich women and kills them. And you know at the start of the story, I think he's on his fourth or his fifth wife, and you know full well that this guy is just marrying women and killing them so he gets their money, and marrying them and killing them so he gets their money. But the way Ellen writes it and the way that he resolves it and the way the situation plays out has that lovely sort of frisson of you like the character, you want to see him succeed, you also really want to see him fail because he's a murderer. But and how do you resolve these two sides of how you feel about it? Or something like the way he approaches a story like A Corner of Paradise, which is in so many ways not even a crime story at all. The first third maybe of that story is somebody talking about the houseplants that they care for in their flat. And okay. But that's one of those things where the psychology that's built up behind it, just through somebody talking about how they like looking after houseplants and how they like trying to raise these plants and make them as healthy as possible. And the way that then turns into a crime story is phenomenal. Then you get something like The Moment of Decision, which is this beautiful suspense story, which kind of is and isn't an inverted mystery because of the nature, again, because of the nature of how it resolves itself. And I mean, you know, Ellen, they are not exclusively inverted mysteries. I would say probably two-thirds of them, maybe between a half and two-thirds of them, could arguably be put into an inverted mystery categorization. But just for the sheer multiplicity of approaches, if you want to get a sense of how the inverted mystery can be played around with, like Death on Christmas Eve is like 4 pages long, and it's this dense, cloying, gothic, horrible, claustrophobic thing, and it just pays off gorgeously. And it does that incredible thing where what the best short stories do, where it makes you reconsider everything that you've read. And you get to the end and go, oh my god, that's incredible. And Ellen just had this really beautiful perspective on how to tell these sorts of stories, and particularly how to play around with, I mean, we've talked about inverted mysteries getting into the character psychology. Ellen is amazing at picking apart the reader psychology, I think. And he came late enough in the development of crime writing and of crime and detective fiction that I think he was really good in his short fiction in manipulating the reader psychology because of the tropes and the expectations that the readers would have encountered prior to reading him.
Yeah, that can be so wonderful when an author correctly identifies the way their reader is thinking and is able just to play off it. I mean, we've talked about how there is this false inverted style of story, and that's exactly what those authors do. They set an expectation and they rely on your sense of traditional structure that you're going to follow along thinking it's hitting this beat, it's hitting this beat, it's hitting this beat. And then they pull the rug out from under you. That book sounds amazing. I've just ordered a copy, Jim. So I look forward to having a read through and listening or reading some of those stories that you referenced. They sound amazing.
Well, I hope to God I haven't malice aforethoughted it for you.
Oh, no. Yeah, let's not make that a verb.
I think at this stage, then, we should probably talk about Strangers on a Train.
Yeah. It's an amazing book. And it's one of those ones that, once again, I didn't think of as an inverted mystery until I kind of picked it up. And I'd read it before, I'd seen the movie. The movie's a little different, but it's an amazing concept of trading murders. Two people meet on a train and they talk about, wouldn't it be a great idea if this person who's hassle for me goes away? And by the way, wouldn't it help you if your wife, who you're trying to get a divorce from, was suddenly out of the picture? And they laugh it off over a couple of drinks. And then lo and behold, that wife turns up dead. And the guy you had the conversation with on the train, he is now expecting you to off his person. And it's not as funny as some of those earlier kind of misadventure type inverted stories, but it is really compelling. I think Highsmith does an amazing job.
I mean, it's post-war. It's 1950. So I think it's written against that background again of that post-war, what do I need to do to make a way for myself? What is the shortest cut for me to make a way for myself in the world? So it's definitely socially written against a very different background to, you know, your lightly comical Richard Hull or whatever else novel. But there is that wonderful suspense, not so much of someone has discovered my crime and so I must commit another murder. As I say, it's almost the inversion of that, because it's, well, I don't want to commit a first murder to begin with, and now I've ended up in this incredibly pressurized situation. I find elements of Highsmith's writing quite problematic. I don't love her written expression. I find her very difficult to read at times, but the way the plot in that unspools, and as you say, it is quite different to the movie, does again demonstrate the versatility of the inverted mystery.
Yeah, and I think that the comparison with the movie is interesting in and of itself, because the movie industry in that period is more conservative than the publishing industry. So the changes that get made effectively remove some of the moral problems with the main character. I mean, you have a legitimate question that you can ask of that main character. By sitting in that train and having that conversation, is he actually responsible in some way for that murder being committed? Because he could have done something, and he could have thought after it happened, maybe that conversation I had about murdering my wife may have led to her being murdered. But he chooses to ignore what's going on. It is this interesting idea of how a crime, the commission or the committing of a crime, affects people. And I think you see that reflected way back. I mean, you're going way back beyond those kind of gothic novels. You can go back to something like Macbeth, where you have a character who commits a murder and he is tormented by it, and it destroys him and it pulls him down. And those two characters go through that same kind of, we've committed this thing, how is it going to change us and affect us, and what kind of people are we going to become, and what will we do as a result? It is such a draining and affecting book. It's one that you kind of, when you're finished with it, you need to read something much lighter, because you feel really pulled through the mill and you feel so disappointed in everybody. That's one of the things inverted novels can do really well. They can make you like someone and then hate what they've done, because you think to yourself, that character has ruined everything for themselves, for the people they love.
Interestingly, what occurs to me now, talking about Strangers on a Train and the movie, obviously the Hitchcock movie, I'm just sitting here thinking, Hitchcock made a few inverted mysteries.
Yes.
And looked at the way in which that knowledge plays on people and affects the situations in which they're in. I mean, probably the most famous one is Rope with Jimmy Stewart.
Which is amazing. That's my favourite Hitchcock film, unsurprisingly.
It is an absolutely brilliant film. I think it's much maligned, and I think it's obviously it's incredibly experimental with the long takes, but it's a beautiful piece of filmmaking, it really is. But obviously in that case, what you've got is the knowledge of the two killers and then Jimmy Stewart gradually coming around to this understanding that something is wrong in the way in which that knowledge plays on him. And I mean, there's that, I don't think it spoils anything to reveal that the murder is discovered, because as you say, the way in which the film industry had to be a lot more conservative at the time. And the moment the murder is discovered, the look on James Stewart's face when he finds the body that you see in the first scene is being hidden in the middle of the room where they're about to have this party is one of the most memorable moments of my film watching life, I think.
Yeah, I think it's so powerful. And you're right. I think that one of the things that really interested Hitchcock and made him steer towards inverted stories rather than traditional detective stories, he did do a couple at the beginning of his career, is he was always much more interested in the idea of building suspense than having a big shocking reveal. Because the big shocking reveal is fine, but you have no build up to it. And the great thing about suspense, he always used the idea of a ticking bomb underneath a chair someone sat on. You spend the whole scene watching that very mundane conversation, and you know that bomb is under there, and maybe it will go off. And it raises your awareness. Likewise, in Rope, everyone's milling around that room. You know the body is in that box. At some point, somebody has got to open that box, but when's it going to happen? Oh, the authors and the filmmakers, the creators who do that well, it is perfection. And I think that that's why this style has become so engaging and so popular. I mean, you look at something like, I mentioned Columbo before, I mentioned it again, I'm doing my watch-a-thon right now. I think that those stories still have a large viewership because you're interested in the game, you know they're going to get caught, and you're just waiting for that moment. And I mean, in those stories, he knows almost from the moment he enters the room who the killer is. It's just, when is that moment going to happen? That popping of the balloon. If it's done badly, it can be really deflating. In the most literal way. I think we've all read inverted stories where we've gone, huh, okay, that didn't have the bang at the end I wanted.
Sometimes the idea itself is more compelling than the story that comes out of it.
Yeah.
To cite Hitchcock again, another one of his inverteds would be I Confess, which starts off, which is this sounds like a fascinating idea. At the beginning of the film, a man who has committed a murder comes to a Roman Catholic priest and confesses to him that he's committed this murder. And then the priest falls under suspicion for the murder. Now, because of the seal of the confessional at the time, the priest was not allowed to tell the police that he knows who the killer is. And so he himself must remain under suspicion for the death while knowing who the killer is, because the killer is someone who is personally known to him ahead of time. And it sounds amazing. And you watch it, and it's mainly just 80 minutes of Montgomery Clift looking very handsome and kind of knitting his brow and worrying his knuckles. And then the detective sort of figures it out through a moment of inspiration at the end. And that is an instant where you go, wow, that sounds incredible. That would be so good. And it's just, it's unfortunately, it's just not. I tell you what, this has also, again, just brought to mind. Have you ever heard of the TV show Murder in Mind?
No, I don't think I have.
I think it's come to mind just because we've started talking about films. It was a TV show from the early 2000s on British TV. And I think I'm right in saying that it was created by Anthony Horowitz, who is more recently making a name for himself, having written some fantastic Sherlock Holmes continuation novels and a handful of absolutely brilliant detective and crime fiction novels for adults, like The Word is Murder, The Sentence is Death, and Magpie Murders. But I think it may have been before he started writing Foyle's War, but essentially the idea is each week you have somebody committing, I'm pretty sure they were all murders because it's called Murder in Mind. So it was just a story of the week, and it was usually someone who's famous on British television. So I don't know, if you look it up, I imagine probably all of the great and the good of British TV drama starred in one at one point. With the idea being that you would see this build-up and the laying of the motive and the laying of the situation and then the planting of the seed of murder. You would have the murder committed, and then I imagine, I can't really remember, but I imagine you would then see their comeuppance. I don't think the BBC would be showing on Saturday night at 8:30 a load of famous people getting away with murder. So they were probably caught afterwards. But I don't remember very specific details, and it's weird that it's just floated back into my brain then. But I do remember enjoying it. And I think it may even have been, you know what, I think just thinking about the timing, it might even have been that got me reading the sorts of inverted mystery novels that I was reading in the early 2000s that made me dislike the inverted mystery. Well, how about that?
But I just quickly looked it up on Wikipedia while you were talking, Jim, and you see the likes of David Suchet was in the first episode playing someone, Diana Rigg, and it occurs to me those roles attracted top-notch talent.
Oh yeah,
because they are the most interesting role in a mystery story. The killer is always the most interesting character. I think most of us have watched an adaptation of some classic mystery novel, and you kind of look at the cast list and you go, oh, that actor is an amazing actor. Why would they be doing this unless they're going to get to do this amazing speech at the end? Yeah. I mean, you make fun of it sometimes, but that gives an actor something to grab hold of and to show some range and some personality and to have fun with. I think that similarly for a novelist, if we jump back to the books for a moment, the character of the killer should be the most interesting character. And if you're telling a story from the perspective of the detective, the problem that some writers run into is that you have to make 5 or 6 interesting and equally interesting perspective killers so you can have that moment at the end. But you've only got 20 or 30 pages for each of them, because if you give them more than that, you're kind of saying, is that guy? So there's kind of this delicate balance that needs to be struck in the detective story. And I think that when you're really interested in exploring a character and delving into them in the way that a Diana Rigg or a David Suchet would want to, those roles are just so much more interesting because you can play around with complexities of, are they really such a bad person? Did they really want to do this thing? How did they feel once they did it? How has it changed them? You can go through so many gradations of character that you just can't show if you're sticking from the point of view of, I can't let you know which of these characters is responsible. Unless you're a really talented writer, which, you know, there are plenty who do it. So I know that you've talked before about some of the reasons that the puzzle mystery kind of went away. And you get writers like Julian Simmons who basically imply there's this superior type of mystery on the horizon, very controversially, of course. I wanted to hear what were some of your thoughts about it. What killed the Golden Age detective novel? And was the inverted mystery responsible? And what has killed the inverted mystery now, or changed it to a point that it's become unrecognizable as being an evolution of the detective story?
I think the puzzle mystery died because they are really hard to write. And if somebody were to sit down, lock themselves away for a year, and write The Problem of the Green Capsule, then congratulations, you've written a book that is as brilliant and as surprising and as multifaceted and as ingenious as The Problem of the Green Capsule. But that book is already sort of 80 years old and it's called The Problem of the Green Capsule. So in order to come up with something legitimately puzzling and new is really, really hard because, I mean, it's not quite this simple, but effectively, crime fiction and the puzzle novel is just combinatorics. You have a certain number of people, you have a certain number of motives, you have a certain number of methods of death, you have a certain number of combinations of those things. And given the density with which that was written during the Golden Age, and I know Julian Simmons in Bloody Murder contends that actually the detective novel is represented by the Golden Age was not the main kind of thoroughfare of fiction. He actually just sees it as this almost entirely incidental side street. And I personally disagree with that quite vehemently. But I think that's why the puzzle novel died out, because even if you write something super ingenious, probably what you've written is The Poison Chocolates Case, which was published in 1929, or probably what you've written is Death of Jezebel from 1948. And these brilliant, brilliant, astonishing books already exist.
No, I think you're so right there, Jim. I think that the problem is that one of, once you've read something, if you see it repeated, you go, that's already been done. And there's this higher expectation of what a puzzle writer should be able to do compared to an inverted mystery writer. Because if you're writing an inverted mystery, there really are only a few things that are extreme enough to ever make you want to kill someone. I've never felt one of those emotions. I'm sure you haven't either, Jim. They are so extreme, you have to be in a life or death situation, or you have to desperately want something that there is no other way of getting out of or getting into, or you have to be on the very edge of existence, or you have to be a sociopath or a psychopath. And there are only so many permutations. So I think we bake into the formula, you're not probably going to show me something I've never seen before. What I want to see is a unique set of character interactions, which is easier because it's less plot driven. It's more, I'm going to put this type of character, this type of character in this type of situation and see what happens. The likes of an Agatha Christie or John Dixon Carr, you need to be exceptionally skilled to come up with a coherent puzzle plot to begin with. It's probably going to take you much longer to write. And then, as you say, it may already have been done by the time you're finished.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, this is not to say that no good puzzle plot mysteries are being written at the moment. No, not at all. We've, you know, talked about Anthony Horowitz, who has written a couple of very good ones. I'm a huge fan of James Scott Burnside, who has, again, written a couple of extremely good puzzle mysteries. But they are rare and they are fewer and further between. This is why we call the Golden Age the Golden Age, right? Because of the density of the quality of this kind of thing. As to the inverted mystery, has the inverted mystery died? I don't know. I don't really read enough, but I can believe that the inverted mystery has struggled because it effectively went on to become the domestic suspense genre, which to a certain extent Kate and I were talking about last week. There's very much these women in peril novels where it's potentially somebody is under threat from somebody else in their house. I mean, even then, what was that Anthony Barclay book? Before the Fact, I suppose, was doing that back in the 1930s. But it's still, I think, the inverted mystery with this idea of knowing that somebody is bad and knowing that there is some shenanigans going on with an obvious malefactor. You know, again, that's Rear Window, right? To go back to Hitchcock.
Yeah.
You don't necessarily know that there is a killer, that there is a crime. But if there is a killer and if there is a crime, I tell you what, it's going to be Raymond Burr. Because, you know, I mean, that's in a way, it is this huge inverted mystery that's, I suppose, slightly more traditional. But I do think in those sorts of ways, the inverted mystery turned into suspense. And I think the suspense novel is now, my understanding is, the suspense novel is now propped up by either effectively your vigilante take, where you've got this anti-hero or anti-heroine going around and correcting wrongs, and so it's inverted because you're supposed to be on the side of this violent sociopath, or you've got your unreliable narrator, and so you don't really know what's happening until page 320 of 340 anyway, because nobody else does either.
I think when it comes to inverted stories, I feel a little like you do about those puzzle mysteries, that some of the most interesting ones are actually the ones being written now and translated into English. You've talked before about Shin Honkaku type mysteries from Japan, which are the kind of Golden Age style stories being written today, emulated. Similarly, I think if you look at authors like Kiyoko Higashino or Fuminori Nakamura, these are Japanese writers, but there are some Korean writers and Chinese writers as well, and obviously a heap of Scandi novels as well, Scandinavian crime, that are much more like the Francis Isles type of puzzly, games being played with the reader, where the reader has a chance, perhaps, of figuring stuff out, rather than those kind of anti-hero type stories that you're referring to. So when I do read modern inverted mysteries, it tends to be in translation.
It's interesting to think then that it could just be we have perhaps extinguished the ingenuity in both in the English market, and that it's the foreign markets that are going to come to our rescue.
Yeah, maybe. And it could just be that ideas get explored, they perhaps get exhausted, and different societies are able to tackle them in different ways because of different cultural aspects that they're able to explore.
Yeah, this is it. Yeah, this is it. Like, you've got that cultural idea of the 30s and the Depression as the background to the 30s, which led to so many pecuniary motives there. And there, and as you say, the way in which order of English society was so shaken up at the end of the Second World War, there's no reason to assume that those facets, I suppose, those societal facets, are going to be felt at the same time, in the same way, all around the world. And so, yeah, different cultures and different countries will come to their own set of broad motivations or interpretations in their own time. That's quite an interesting thought, actually.
Yeah, we were making recommendations of Golden Age books. If you're a Golden Age reader, I would certainly suggest that you want to read something like Malice by Kiego Higashino. I think that if you enjoy anything like those 1930s, 1940s style, it is definitely a very modern book in some respects. It involves technology in a way that, you know, those Golden Age books don't. If it's never been done in a culture's literary scene before, it has that sense of something exciting and new, and they're using it in a different way that perhaps we wouldn't feel capable of doing today. Or another one that I would certainly suggest is a book called A Quiet Place by Saiko Matsumoto. That one tells the story of a man who's away on business, and he hears that his wife has died while he's away, unexpectedly. And when he returns home, he essentially chooses to investigate what caused her to take her own life. So it is a mystery. We know who killed her. It's her. And it's just, what were the feelings behind it? What was the motive for doing it? And it's very culturally specific. You couldn't tell that story in Western culture. But you can explore these different culturally relevant ideas.
Right. Well, I think we've pretty much covered the gamut of the inverted mystery there, haven't we? I think we started off in the Golden Age with novels. We've ended up with Jim Thompson in the 50s and 60s. We've done a bit of domestic suspense. We've gone back to Patricia Highsmith. Then we've gone some short stories. We've done Hitchcock and the movies. We had a bit of a diversion into TV. I don't think, unless you want to start talking about comic books, I don't think there's too much else left to discuss.
Well, thank you so much, Jim, for having me on. I really enjoy chatting about inverted mysteries at any opportunity.
Yeah, thanks, Aidan. This has been really good fun. Let's do it again sometime, hey?
Sounds great.
Cool. Thanks, man.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you very much, Jim. Bye-bye.